One, two.
Welcome to the Honky Tonk Papa Podcast, a journey into the legacy of Atlanta legend Whit Connor. He's our Honky Tonk Papa, but she's been calling him Papa as long as she's been talking. Here's your host, Whit's daughter, Amy Connor Hudson.
I'm so glad to have you with us for a brand new series of the Honky Tonk Papa Podcast, a journey into the life and legacy of my father, Atlanta artist and musician, Whit Connor. After a long COVID hiatus, we're back with a three-parter called Whit the Songwriter. It's a deep dive into his original songs. With each of the three episodes, we're going to break down two songs. You'll hear excerpts of different versions played by Whit and others, as well as various perspectives and stories from some of the people who were closest to the songs, family members, fellow musicians, and on occasion, even Whit himself. The seeds for this project were planted in February of last year, right before the pandemic shut things down. Lee Connell, one of my Baltimore cousins, was interested in learning more about Whit's songwriting. He decided to begin interviewing folks via phone, and over time captured some incredible material. Lee's interest in the subject comes naturally, as he's a wonderful musician, singer, and songwriter in his own right. I think you'll agree he's got some skills at podcasting as well, because he's going to be your host for this series. It's been such a pleasure to collaborate with Lee on this project, and I absolutely love what he's created. Let's sit back and enjoy Whit the Songwriter Part 1, featuring the songs Holy Robes and Ponce de Leon Avenue.
Whit Connor was a man of many talents. A boy with a passion for drawing, he would go on to achieve degrees in fine art and produce an impressive body of paintings and drawings in a variety of styles. He shared the knowledge of his craft with a generation of students through a lifetime of teaching. In more recent years, he turned increasingly in a folk art direction, meticulously festooning everyday items, furnishings, musical instruments, and repurposed taxidermy with gaudy paints, glitter, sequins, and brightly colored beads. Many, however, know Whit Connor mainly through his music. As a singer, musician, and bandleader, Whit was a fixture of the Atlanta folk music scene from the 70s onward. He was a frequent presence at music camps and festivals, and he could be found at countless jams in living rooms and on back porches all around town. Whit's original songs were held in high regard and fit seamlessly into the eclectic breadth of American folk music that he loved. Backed by his powerful baritone, his driving harmonica, or Cajun accordion, his songs could bring a crowd to its feet and have them singing and dancing along. After Whit's passing on August 28, 2016, I wondered why I'd never asked him about songwriting. I knew nothing of Whit's process or his development as a songwriter. As a songwriter myself, I've always been interested in how others do what they do, where they find inspirations, who their influences are, the stories behind the genesis of particular songs, and how they approach the littlest details of crafting a song. I also wondered if there were more than the half dozen or so original songs I already knew. Was there a trove of lesser-known gems just waiting to be discovered? Whit's songs borrowed from a variety of styles: the blues, gospel, Cajun, zydeco, hillbilly, honky-tonk, and more. I wondered how the son of a New York ad man and a woman who danced on Broadway came to love this music. My father is Whit's older brother, Doug, and I've been hearing my whole life about a singular woman named Lucille Dillard. She was the family's African-American housekeeper, who ran the household and saw to the five children. My dad told me about her influence on the kids' musical tastes.
It was she who had the radio on. When the folks went out, the radio went on. And on the radio on Saturday night, I can remember the WSB Barn Dance, which was country music from Atlanta, which had done more or less a capital of country music before Nashville took it over.
And what kind of musicians were featured on that show?
Well, James and Martha Carson sang gospel tunes. There were guitar pickers and mandolin pickers and just ordinary country music of the period. It was a country music station, you know, a hillbilly music station and gospel music. The second show that came on after WSB Barn Dance was Louisiana Hayride, and that came from Shreveport, Louisiana, and it was the same. It was hillbilly music and gospel music, you know. And then there was the Grand Ole Opry after that, and I can remember Lucille thought Minnie Pearl was the funniest thing she ever heard. Ernest Tubb and all those early country music musicians, Eddie Arnold, Red Foley. Those were probably the most influential songs that any of us ever heard. It was just, the radio was on all the time, from like 6 o'clock to midnight, music all the time.
So were you actively listening, or was it just like in the air around you? Was it?
I think we were listening. I don't remember doing other things. It was time to settle down and listen to the radio.
And Whit was listening too?
I think he was influenced in a major way by all that. Yeah, I have no doubt that that's the case.
Whit spoke of Lucille to his daughter Amy in July of 2016. This was during the last 2 months of his life when he was at home under hospice care. As I saw on several visits, the house was often filled with friends, neighbors, and family. There was lots of music and lots of conversation. Amy was often there during the evenings and made a habit of turning on her phone to either interview Whit or simply capture the music or whatever he was discussing with guests. On this occasion, he spoke of how much Lucille's taste in music influenced him. You might hear the sound of Whit's oxygen tank or other household sounds in the background.
So if you had to list or give me or just tell me passionately of your favorite musical groups or musicians, you know, who comes to mind? And you don't have to remember them all now, but if just who comes to mind?
Oh.
The forefront of your mind.
Hank Williams, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that era of hillbilly music, which is what we called it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That we listened to on the radio.
And Lucille? Lucille was the one who turned you on to...
I'll tell you, the Lucille connection, this is really good, because the cool thing about it is she, you know, exposed me to hillbilly music before one thing. So what she would do is tune in to the WSB Barn Dance,
mm-hmm.
which was then followed by the network version of the Grand Ole Opry, which was a 30-minute program that went out to the nation at large. You know, she liked whatever gospel music she could pick up. But she loved Minnie Pearl, you know, and thought it was funny. You know, and she loved Hank Williams, too. A lot of black folks did.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, that was that, you know. That exposure came with her.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Paul Kana, who is Witt's next younger brother, talking about the influence of popular music in the early 50s.
A lot of country singers were popular among kids, and singers like Hank Williams, Lefty Frizzell, Webb Pierce, these guys that were the big stars in the early 1950s before rock and roll hit. And Witt was a young adolescent, early adolescent at the time in the early 50s, and he ended up buying Hank Williams records, and then all these other people. His record collection was the big music educational event in my life.
Witt told Amy about the first time he heard Elvis on the radio singing "That's All Right, Mama." You'll hear Witt's wife, Barbara Panterkana, chiming in.
You know, my parents didn't make me work in the summers, and I was free to fish the dial, you know, for whatever. And so that's one thing I did at night was, and I pulled in this station from Memphis. Anyway. You know, I heard it, and they were showcasing, and it was kind of like a tease, because it was Dewey Phillips' radio show, and he was not related to Sam Phillips, but he was a DJ in Memphis, and so he played this thing, and he played it all night.
People were calling in.
That's cool.
Well, it was a hit, and they, like I'm saying, they did it over and over and over again because.
And you were a night owl.
And I was a night owl.
Couldn't sleep.
So I heard it over and over again and had these wonders about it. So I guess they played their show in Overton Park on Sunday.
And the word was out.
And it was out. Yeah, it was a promotional situation they were doing. So, hot dog. I was just tuned in, and lucky enough to just have been there.
Yeah, man.
Paul told me about Witt's first guitar and his first public performance when he played a song he'd written called The Little Rock Rock. It was a response to those who were against school integration, just beginning in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Back when Witt was listening to these country singers, he wanted a guitar of his own, and he got one for Christmas, and it could have been 54 when he would have been 15. But what it was, Witt was, this would have been at the time of the school integration. It was all in the news, and it was the first moment of school integration in the South, and the writing was on the wall that it was going to happen in each state by state. The attitude of the song is somewhat flippant. It was coming, you know, just commenting on there were those people who were saying that, get out of my school, I don't want you in my school. That wasn't Witt's position. He was just reflecting that being in the air. There was a small party going on. It was like maybe 12 people. And my mother called Witt and said, come out here and sing your song for us. But he came out with his guitar. And Witt was a pretty shy guy. But like so many shy musical artists, they can perform and break through the wall of shyness while they're singing or playing an instrument. And it was a big hit. I mean, it was an influential bit of encouragement, I would have to think. So that was the earliest performance I remember him performing a song, and his earliest song.
After high school, Witt attended the Ringling School of Art in Sarasota, Florida, during the 57 to 58 school year. Doug Khanna.
And he started playing Elvis Presley music. And I don't know whether he had a guitar, and I don't think he took mine, but he came back from that school and had turned into a musician. That's his transitional years. When, if you're looking for, you know, where the blossom takes place, yes. I would look right at that year. And he got in trouble with the authorities because they were, you know, I suppose there was a little hooch going on too, but so there was music and alcohol and girls and fun and art. Yeah, that's when he really came out of his shell.
Paul Khanna.
The next event where he got encouragement from, and this time it was from his peers, it was when he went to art school at the Ringling School of Art in Sarasota, Florida, when he was 18. And the first day he was on campus, he was walking along, you know, a public walkway outdoors, and this guy saw him carrying his guitar. And he said to him, "Do you play that thing?" And he said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Come with me." And he took him immediately to this gathering that was taking place on the campus. And there were some kids gathered around, and these were art students. So, you know, some of them were plugged into the current bohemianism. The whole thing of the Beat Generation was just starting to spread into the general consciousness of the United States. So anyway, so these kids, you know, some of these art student kids, he came in and I think there were some other people with instruments, but it was all acoustic, and they must have found something they could agree on playing, because I don't think he was necessarily playing by himself, but he might have, you know, soloed as far as singing. He probably did, you know, some country song, or by that time, you know, some Elvis song. And he got approval and encouragement from that event.
At the same time he was blossoming as a young artist and musician, it's no secret that Witt was battling depression. Barbara Panner Khanna described an epiphany that Witt experienced at Ringling that may have foretold his later embrace of Buddhism.
He told me that he was suffering a lot early in his life, and that's how he got into reading about psychology and philosophy and world religions. He said that once when he was in college, in art school, at Ringling Art School, that he was looking out the window and that he got this really intense feeling about the beauty of everything. And he just had this feeling that it's going to be okay. Now, before that, I don't know if he was worried, he was fretting. I don't know if it's when he got expelled and he was going to have to leave, but he just had this feeling.
The decade of the 60s saw Witt complete college at the Atlanta School of Art, graduating first in his class, and receive an MFA at Tulane University. He married his first wife, Jeanette, with whom he had two daughters, Amy and Jenny, and taught art at several colleges. Performing music seems to have been mostly on the back burner. He eventually landed a permanent position in the art department of the Georgia Tech School of Architecture, where he started playing and singing with colleague Albert Smith.
We just got to be friends, and we started sitting around playing I didn't play any. I mean, I've always dabbled with the guitar, but I never really learned how to play. But he would play the mandolin or the guitar, and we would sing together. I never knew anything about singing harmony or anything, but somehow or another, it just started happening, you know. So.
Sweet magnolia from Mongolia, that I need to follow you. Sweet magnolia from Mongolia, that I need to follow you. Sweet magnolia from Mongolia, that I need to follow you.
I had grown up listening to hillbilly music and rhythm and blues. That was my, you know, my background. Anyway, Whit, you know, he knew so much about hillbilly music. He and Paul both were like historians. I mean, they just had all this stuff. He was big on a lot of bluegrass stuff that I'd never heard. And I'd never even heard the term bluegrass, I don't suppose. But I went with him, and I guess Jeanette went, and Roberta, and we went up to Livonia, Georgia, to the Bluegrass Festival, and saw Bill Monroe and Ralph Stanley and Reno and Smiley. Whit and I got involved in the Atlanta Area Friends of Folk Music, and we started hanging out with some of those folks, or all of them, I guess, and they would have little concerts and campouts and one thing and another, and we started performing in that situation.
When old Gabriel blows his trumpet and we walk the streets of gold,
I have a new body.
Praise the Lord, I'll have a new life. Won't it be so bright and fair when we meet our loved ones by?
I have a new body.
Praise the Lord, I'll have a new life.
I'll have a new home.
Holy glory.
The thrift God
I found.
Be no more sorrow.
No more pain, I'll be no more pride.
Praise in the likeness
in his likeness.
Live
in paradise.
I'll have a new body.
Praise the Lord, I'll have a new life.
There was a student who was not an architecture student. He was a roommate of a architecture student, and he thought there was one professor named Whitten Albert. And anyway, that was kind of funny. And people would, I don't know why they would get us confused, because I would probably tower over Whit by an inch and a half, you know? He had straight gray hair, and I had curly gray hair and a curly beard. He had a kind of straight beard, you know. The only thing we had in common other than the coloration of our hair was neither one of us had an ass. We both had saggy Levi's, so I guess going away we kind of favored a lot more.
That must have been it. Was that part of your stage patter? I mean, that...
I don't know. Probably.
I hope so.
I didn't have a whole lot to say, and but we had fun. We had, that was the main thing. We had a good time, and it was kind of bizarre.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Talking to Paul, Albert, and Barbara, I learned that around this time, in the early 70s, Whit wrote a couple of songs which have been lost. One may have been a kid's song, the other a comic rock and roll number. But this was also the start of an extremely productive period of serious songwriting. Paul Connor told me about first hearing the song Holy Robes and its possible connection to the religious art and iconography that Whit was fascinated with.
Now, Holy Robes has an interesting connection with the art that he was doing at the time, because in particular, there was one drawing that he had done that I encountered. It was in 1973, in the spring of 73, I applied for a job at the Atlanta Public Library, and the director of personnel showed me into his office, and there on the wall was a drawing Witt did of a figure out of the Bible in robes. He looked like an Old Testament patriarch in these voluminous robes, long beard, long hair, and he was kneeling down on the floor of the ocean, and above him was this very large squid-like creature that was shooting a jet of water. It wasn't dark ink. It was like it was water that was, and it was like he was a benediction, a blessing to this kneeling figure that he was hovering above. So it's a very surrealistic image, and one that, in fact, the guy whose office I was in, he said, your brother's pretty weird, judging from this drawing, which happened to be in his office because the city of Atlanta bought the drawing at an art show. They bought several works of art, and they used them to decorate offices around the city, and the city ran the library, so that's how I did it up at the library. So he was using these images from religious art of the 20th century of the religious tracts and pamphlets. You would encounter these things, you know, people would be passing them out in the street downtown or whatever, and I was always intrigued by these things because a lot of times the graphics were just interesting in a crazy way. And it was probably because Witt had introduced me to even thinking about this, because he was using these modern Protestant religious images in collages or in drawings where they were juxtaposed with other things as in a collage.
Barbara Panter Khanna.
You know, he was real interested in religious imagery. He liked the scene of the graves opening and people rising up out of the grave. He would find that in books and add it to, like, the inside of one of the guitars he made with Mom rising up and Pop and Bud and Sis standing there looking so thrilled.
Again, Paul Khanna.
His purpose was not religious at all. His purpose was artistic and making interesting images. At the same time, he wrote this song called Holy Robes, which I have to connect to the works of art. And the difference in the song is the song really comes from a place of belief, it sounds like to me, which is different from how in the art. The art, in a sense, you know, a believer would look at the art and say that they're the works of a heretic. But the song Holy Robes wasn't like that at all. It was a song about how rough life is, but there's something better to look forward to. Or there, at least there should be. It should be so, the song says. It is right. It should be so. But it's presented in a sense of the singer believes this is what's going to happen. His thinking evolved over a period. But he was a Buddhist, and the idea of meeting your friends and loved ones in heaven, it just wasn't a part of Buddhism. It was more about writing a song and fitting into a tradition. And the sentiments in the song are wonderful.
Let's hear a clip from Holy Robes. Here's the final verse, chorus, and outro from a big jam session that was held the night of Witt's memorial service, September 3rd, 2016. I love how the voices swell in the chorus.
It should be so.
When I played this recording for Amy, she remembered another visit during her father's illness when she captured a conversation about holy robes. They were watching a video Michael Daves had shot of Whit and Barbara backstage at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville singing the song. Michael, an acclaimed musician himself, is one of their musical godchildren. That night he was opening for Punch Brothers and had invited them to the show. You'll hear a bit of commentary as Whit and Barbara are watching the video. Here are Whit and Barbara singing Holy Robes.
So that is more to do with current condition.
Okay.
They were listening because Barbara had gotten an email from their friend Jen Larson, a musician and singer who has often accompanied Michael Daves. She was writing to say that she and Michael had just performed Holy Robes at their church, Old First, in Brooklyn, New York. At the time, she was living in Brooklyn, but would soon be moving to Nashville to start her new job as curator of the Grand Ole Opry Museum. Here's Barbara reading Jen's email.
Hi, Barbara. So sorry that my return message is slow to arrive. Thank you so much for your love and support as I make this huge move down to Nashville. I can't imagine more compelling and amazing reason to leave my life here in Brooklyn. I can't believe I'm going to be the person in charge of all that Opry history, but I hope to bring all of my NYC experience and love of the music down there and really dial into what the collection needs in terms of its care and long-term preservation.
Yeah.
Michael may have been in touch with you already, but we sang Holy Robes this past Sunday at the church service at Old First. I learned it from watching Michael's iPhone footage of you both singing it backstage at the Ryman. Very cool. What a pleasure to lift that song up and share it with everyone. I was in tears immediately after getting through it, thinking so much of you and Whit, and of how much I enjoy connecting musically with Michael. Not tears of sadness, but just for how beautiful and how difficult life is as we each move through the changes and challenges that we're each confronted with.
Lucky for us, Jen included the recording with her email. Let's take a listen along with Whit, Barbara, and Amy.
Such a good, you're an excellent songwriter.
Well, it takes me.
You really are. I mean, I
mean, if it takes 50 years to write each one, you know, it's crazy.
When I think about Ponce de Leon and that one, and of course, Dark Angels, I think all three of those songs are brilliant.
My tears stretched down now.
long white line out on that sad highway. The woman that I left behind asked me to go away, but this monster Leon Avenue.
Paul also mentioned Ponce de Leon Avenue, possibly Witt's most well-known and beloved song. The alcohol and breakup-fueled pathos of the lyric against the backdrop of seedy old Atlanta, along with the reverb-drenched guitar riffs played so well here by Barbara's son John Ferguson, would make this song right at home on country radio or on any jukebox from Bakersfield to Nashville from about the 1950s onward. I think I even hear a little nod to George Jones in Witt's phrasing in places on this recording.
I know some of the lover holds her tight there in my place and lays his head upon my bed deep in her warm embrace. And I watch as strangers in their cars go out at night.
Paul Kana.
So this is 1972, 73, and we were driving down Ponce de Leon Avenue, and it just occurred to me, I said to him, you know, you ought to write a song about Ponce de Leon, because it was such a presence in our thinking about Atlanta. And Ponce de Leon at the time had become kind of seedy. There was the Hotel Claremont, and it was known for being a place where you could find prostitutes. And there was just a down-and-out seediness to part of Ponce de Leon Avenue at the time. Shows up in the song, you know. So I just suggested that. I thought, yeah, a song about Ponce de Leon. Witt ought to write a song. And then I don't remember when he sang it for me, but he wrote the song. I don't remember him presenting it piecemeal over time. He just said, I've got a song about Ponce de Leon. And he sang it, and I really don't remember, but I must have thought it was great, because I always thought it was great. So the first time I heard it, I must have reacted that way. He wrote it, and that was it. It was finished.
Back at home, in the summer of 2016, Witt recalled for Amy.
I was leaving Albert's one night, and I had been at his house. And there was a stretch of road there that, you know, had a white line, which was becoming something of the past. So I just started with the line, my tears stretched down that long white line. Out on that sad highway, the woman that I left behind asked me to go away. It's really stupid, you know.
No, it's not.
But it's basic. As basic as you can get.
So there it was on the ride home.
So there it was, almost written. And so, you know, wrote the song, and Lewis Wills would get me to sing it at parties because he thought it was cool. So that's kind of how that started, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a hillbilly song to me, in my mind. And of course in everybody else's, I would think, you know.
Yeah.
So you can say that that was the first song I deliberately started putting together as a song, and it was in my mind a country song.
Did the melody come to you?
It all came together. it all came together.
And you just started humming the tune, and that was it just...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Panter Khanna.
And Lewis said, okay, everybody hush now. I want you to hear this. This is an original song. And Witt sang Ponce de Leon Avenue.
Wow.
And it was amazing. You know, my eyes were bulging. We tended to get together weekly at somebody's house or another and sing. And so there was a lot of old country, bluegrass, old-time fiddle tunes, and Witt would usually be asked to sing, or sometimes at least to sing, Ponce de Leon Avenue. Witt put so much emotion into his singing, and he sang loud, but he didn't sing in this, he sang in this fluid way of bending notes, sort of like Ralph Stanley or like blues singers do. And you could just hear the emotion.
Albert Smith.
Ponce de Leon Avenue is the one that, I mean, it's just so, it's just like driving down the street, you know? You know, but nobody else saw it the way he did, you know?
Nobody else saw
possibly on Avenue the way he did.
Yeah.
But then he brought a vision or an experience to life in the song, you know. He just had a magical way of thinking and putting things together, and or maybe even, especially in his painting, of opposing things, images that what you wouldn't normally think of seeing him that way, but he did, you know. But anyway, he was a very creative person, a little shocking at times, but all in a good way.
John Ferguson was not only Witt's stepson, but played lead guitar in their band Hair of the Dog and produced the band's two CDs. John describes how Ponce de Leon came to be included on the first record in 1997.
Yeah, Ponce de Leon, what a song. And of course, you'd have to be a Atlanta resident to know Ponce de Leon and what it represented. And you know, Witt loved to say it was the haunt of denizens of the night, with the Plaza Drugs there and all it, you know, all that went along with that, and the scene going on the corner out there, and just the Claremont Lounge and the whole bit. And you know, we'd have been doing that song when we recorded that for, I don't know, 15 years at least, if not more. But it had always been him playing it on acoustic, and of course with Mom's awesome harmony, you know, and was super powerful song. And it wasn't on the list of for the plan for the first Hair of the Dog record, but we had a little bit of maybe like a half day of time left from the full band session, from what we had budgeted for time in the studio. And so that it was put together right then and there. As far as I know, as far as I can remember, the, you know, the signature riff and all of that, that got worked out right there on the spot. We had a great bass and drum team in there, and just everyone figured out what they had to do pretty quickly, and we did it and got through it, you know, and set up a good backing track for it. And so, yeah, that was thrown together just at the last second, and well, it was just one of those days when everything goes right, you know.
So you just came up with that riff on the spot?
I can't quite remember, but yeah, it was that riff. None of that existed before that afternoon. I know that much, and I just kind of worked it out in my brain and then was able to convey it. And it somehow, you know, just the guys figured out what to do, and we put it together, and that was that. because the timing wasn't even really set in stone. It was, he would hold the measures differently, you know, going, ending one part and starting another. So we had to make it a certain way, because there's otherwise it never would have gone down. Yeah, we were able to just decide what it was and make it what it was, and we all put it together because we were all on at that moment, you know. That was a good thing.
Let's listen to the full track as it was recorded that day.
Some place to stay, 'cause they said Atlanta is the town to drive your blues away. Strangers in their cars go out at night to play, but a thousand go-go girls in bars can't drive these blues away.
Michael Daves, who we heard earlier on the last version of Holy Robes, has frequently performed Witt's songs. He told me about an exciting new project he's working on, partly inspired by Ponce.
Well, his song Ponce de Leon Avenue is one I'm currently building a new album project around. Yeah. That's something I've been working on for, I guess, you know, 2 or 3 years at this point. But I decided to make a whole record of songs connected to the Ponce de Leon corridor, of Atlanta, because there was so much good musical history kind of along and near the Ponce de Leon corridor, going back to the Fiddle Fest, you know, the fiddle conventions from the teens through the early 30s. So anyways, it's a project sort of connecting the music related to a very narrow place, you know, Ponce de Leon Avenue, over kind of a wide time from the 1920s through the 1990s. And, you know, what song is, you know, so vividly, you know, kind of recounting the sort of seediness of, you know, the Plaza Drugs and theater, and you got the Claremont Lounge down there, and, you know, it's such a picture of an old Atlanta that's mostly gone. You know, I think the Plaza Drugstore is like now an Urban Outfitters or something like that. But I love the song just in its own right, but I love its connection to, you know, this kind of old Atlanta history, which, you know, definitely pre-Olympics. you know, and it'd been Wit and Barbara and the whole musical community that, you know, they helped nurture around them is sort of a big part of that project for me and inspiration.
Here's a sneak peek into Michael's rendition of Ponce. When Witt wrote Ponce and Holy Robes in the early 70s, he was really hitting his stride. During this time, he also wrote Dark Angels, a story of regret and second chances, with a surprise twist at the end. We'll pick things up in our next episode with a closer look at Dark Angels and another Honky Tonk original, Hungry Ghosts. In the third and final episode on Witt the Songwriter, we'll hear two more Witt originals, Bon Riant and Roving Rounder. And I'll keep exploring Witt's songwriting with some of the people who knew him best. Please visit the Honky Tonk Papa website, that's honkytonkpapa.com, to see video of Witt and Barbara at the Ryman and photos of people featured in this episode. Until then, thanks for listening, and laissez les bons temps rouler.